In 3, 2, 1.
Bing bong.
Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hi, I am Will Leach. And this is episode 18 of the Grierson and Leach podcast at the New Republic. Grierson is back from France. You are back from France. You are no longer in France. You are back in the good old U.S. of A. How's it feel?
It feels very nice.
Thank you. That is the sort of description I suspect, and I would expect from a professional critic. Well, we're going to get into that because today we're going to talk about your time at the Cannes Film Festival. First off, we remind everyone that we are, of course, Grierson Leach. You can find us on Twitter at Grierson Leach, GRIERSONLEITCH. And of course, we remind you always, please subscribe to us on iTunes and give us a nice review. If you give us a nice review with the name of a movie in it, in our reboot segment, we will review your movie and read your request. We're not doing that this week, though, because we have too much to get into. Now we're going to talk about Tim's time at France. The Cannes Film Festival, your third film festival. And Grierson, I've not been to the Cannes Film Festival. The initial takeaway that I had from Cannes is, A, this seemed to be a pretty good Cannes Film Festival. People were generally impressed with it. And the jury screwed everything up and got everything wrong. By the way, after we talked about Cannes, we're going to talk about the Nice Guys and Neighbors too. I forgot to mention that, but we're going to get to that in a moment.
You're right on both counts. Yes, it was a very good year. I mean, it's only been my third, so I have to be, I feel like, a little tempered in terms of how I felt. But I thought it was a really good slate of films. There were 21 films this year, more than usual. And yes, the jury got absolutely wrong almost entirely across the board. It was kind of, I was flying home on Sunday, the 22nd, the day that they announced the awards. I flew from Nice to New York and then New York to Los Angeles. When my plane landed in New York, I quickly got on my phone to check to see the winners. And I thought it was a joke when I looked at Twitter. The film that won the Palme d'Or, the top prize, I, Daniel Blake from Ken Loach, is a perfectly good movie. I ranked all 33 movies I saw. It was number 14 on my list. It's a very solid movie. In fact, its first half is really good. I think it kind of loses its way as it goes along, but it's a perfectly good movie. There were many, many, many movies that were better.
And generally considered better.
And I would say that for the most part, the critical consensus was where I landed as well. So yeah, I think most critics were very surprised. The real shock
The big shock was which movie?
The second prize, the Grand Prix winner, was Xavier Dolan's It's Only the End of the World, which I thought was the worst film I saw at the festival. I'm not alone in thinking it was the worst or one of the worst. I think if you asked most people, and in fact, I had this debate with some colleagues at one dinner I was at.
Okay, let's dig into that a little bit. First off, okay, you did your 33 movies. Number 33, I'm looking at the list right now. We're going to get into your number one in a little bit. Your bottom three movies are, number 31 is The Last Face, which is the much derided. This was the one where my phone jumped out of my hand and hit me in the face when everybody got out of the screening for that one. That is written and directed by Sean Penn, who has made some good movies before, by the way. Like, it's not, like, The Crossing Guard is good, and with The Pledge.
The Pledge is very, very good, and Into the Wild is also good.
This is The Last Face, and this was the one that, when it came, that it felt like people were, it was like the scene in the old time movie where everybody ran to the payphones after they announced the verdict of something and said the movie is guilty of being not only terrible but offensive in a lot of ways. That's your 31, so you're on the same page. Do you agree with that general consensus about Last Face, that it is not only bad but offensive?
To me, it's too boring to really be offensive because it's just not well done. It is a classically well-intentioned liberal movie that just sort of falls flat on its face.
What did people find offensive?
In terms of background, for people who don't know, it's not based on a true story, but it's about these two doctors who work across Africa in different war-torn countries, and they're played by Javier Bardem and Charlize Theron. They fall in love, and the movie wants to be this look at these displaced people in these war-torn areas, but it really is more about a love story between these two people who are essentially mouthpieces for different viewpoints on how you handle that kind of mass atrocity? Do you work kind of on like on the front lines and try and help a person at a time? Or do you try and make a bigger thing by going to the media or trying to go through different organizations to spread awareness on a more global scale?
Sounds scintillating so far.
I was gonna say if you're drawn in so far, oh wait, there's more from there.
Like the two white people falling in love against the backdrop of insert name of global atrocity, not
yes,
loving white people.
And that's exactly what it is. I mean, it is not an exaggeration to say that if you see a black face on the screen in this movie, they are usually being blown up, or they're in a hospital room somewhere, or they're perhaps going to teach us some sort of important lesson about perseverance and survival and like that. There is only one person of color in this movie I can think of, really, who has any kind of remote connection to the overall plot. I mean, Bardem and Theron are front and center in this movie. And so I think you can definitely perceive it to be offensive. To me, it's just so poorly handled. It almost doesn't rise to the level of offensive because it's not conscious of it. It's just sort of badly, boringly made.
Awesome. So that's fun.
There's always a film at Cannes in the competition where people, they don't just dislike the movie. They do not understand why it's in the competition, because those are supposed to be the most prestigious films in the festival. Last year, that movie was The Sea of Trees, which has still not come out. Now the question is, will The Last Face ever see the light of day? People don't just dislike this movie. They don't understand why it was in the competition at all.
So that's 31 on your list. 32 is Money Monster, which you actually just talked about on the podcast last week. And you hated it and gave it a C-, right?
That's correct.
Yeah,
yes.
So clearly a movie that you highly dislike, a movie that is even surprising. I know it was not in competition, but you know, it did not, it's generally been derided and ignored, and everybody recognizes that it's not good. That's 32. Number 33 on your list is the movie that won second place prize on the list. The movie of all the movies, and some of the movies that you're seeing on here have been pretty derided movies I know that you are not crazy about. Number 33, It's Only the End of the World. Is this, like, if you were to see this in the wild, like, never mind, you weren't seeing in this can. If you were to see this in the wild, would you think, man, this movie really stinks? Or is it like the hothouse of a festival that gets everybody fired up to rip on it that way?
I think it's just terrible.
Okay, explain to us why it's terrible. Well, first off, it's by Xavier Dolan, who did Mommy. He's very young. He's 27. He's kind of this, he's clearly, I think he's thought of to be, at the very least, a very talented director. Before we talk about it winning the prize, why is it so bad?
In terms of backing up just for a second, I've liked Dolan's earlier films. I liked Mommy. I liked Lawrence Anyways. So I'm not someone who actively just dislikes this guy like a lot of critics are, who absolutely just cannot stand the guy. It's based on a play that was made in the early 1990s, I believe. And it's about this young kid going home. He's a writer going to see his family, who he has not seen for 12 years. In the cast includes Marion Cotillard, Vincent Cassel. It's about, and this is not an exaggeration, it's about a family yelling at each other with cameras right in the actors' faces. For people who sort of remember the late 90s or the early 2000s, when DV cameras started to really populate the indie film world, you had movies like Personal Velocity or Pieces of April, things like that, where they were making these really kind of handheld, intimate movies shot on DV, and the DV cameras at the time were still pretty unsophisticated, and they looked really grainy and crappy. This movie, I actually wonder if Dolan was trying to kind of evoke that era, because it looks terrible. And it looks terrible in a way that I thought, is this conscious? Because I can't tell. And all of the actors have the cameras so close to their faces that they look so deeply unappealing. And you don't even get to really know any of the characters at all, despite all of the yelling and tense conversations they have with each other. Marion Cotillard is never going to give a worse performance than she does in this movie. She plays a sort of the awkward, nervous wife of Vincent Cassel's character, and it's so misjudged that I kept thinking, is there a twist here? Is she supposed to be sort of like missing a couple chromosomes? What's going on exactly? No, the character is just supposed to be cute in an awkward, nervous way, kind of from beginning to end. And this movie is only about 90 minutes long. It's just painful and dreadful to sit through. It's the kind of movie where I paid a lot of attention to what songs were on the soundtrack, thinking, yeah, I haven't listened to that Grimes album in a while. I should listen to that again. Or, oh my God, in 2016, people are still using Moby songs from 1999 for big emotional, cathartic moments in their films. It's absolutely dreadful.
What grade did you give it?
I'd have to go back and look. Either a C- or a D+. I can't remember. Wow. It's pretty awful. I absolutely hated it. And
you were not alone in this. You are hardly a minority opinion on this.
Nobody gives a good performance in It's Only the End of the World. And it's and as always, I'm cognizant of the fact that people might hear someone say this type of thing and go, oh my God, I cannot wait to see this movie now. I'm not sure there's much pleasure to be derived from The Duel On. It's just sort of, it's not like campy fun or like bad and fun in that way. It's just kind of awful.
Okay, so this gets us to our next point. How does this win? Like, there's been some weird choices in the past at the Cannes Film Festival, or at least get second place or whatever we're calling it. There have been some weird choices in the past. Fahrenheit 9/11 being one of the most famous ones, but at least you could understand everyone getting swept up in the moment on that one. This appears to have been like people hated this movie. I think they hissed it when he got the award for crying out loud, which is a different discussion, whether that's appropriate or not. Is George Miller just not paying attention? I think that's a good filmmaker. What is the disconnect, if it can possibly be explained?
I think there's two things to mention. Number one, I think it's a mistake to look at the jury president and think he's going to pick a movie that he would make himself. And I think number two, there is, I forget, it's either 8 or 9 members of the jury, which also includes Kirsten Dunst was also on the jury. Mads Mikkelsen was on the jury. So you have producers or directors or actors all kind of working together. And there can be a certain sense of, if you want best director for this, okay, we'll let you guys have this, but the other ones of us who like this, we'll give it screenplay. And there's almost sometimes a dividing up of one for you, one for me, one for this other person on the jury, that type of thing. I think one of the best comments I've seen was from the New Yorker's Richard Brody, who said, it's always a mistake to give filmmakers a certain amount of credit because they make mistakes in their own movies all the time. And so this idea that they're going to somehow not make mistakes in terms of what they pick is an absolute mistake. I would say, why did The Duel On do so well on that jury? It's a very actorly movie. I can see certain people responding to the theatrics of the film and mistake it for good acting, frankly. And what was actually very interesting was that Laszlo Nemish, who is the director of Son of Saul that was at Cannes last year, made a comment that Duel On was on the jury last year. And Nemish said, well, I didn't let that influence me, obviously, but I of course, thought about the fact that Duel On was on the jury. And what he didn't say was that gave me the second prize, because Son of Saul got the second prize last year at the Cannes Film Festival. It's fascinating to sort of see how they end up. But just like with the Oscars, there's almost no point in putting too much of a meaning on it. The only meaning I would put on it is that again and again and again, there were very few choices that they made that I agree with. And most of them I thought, no. Because I saw the movies and I thought, no, this is actually better than this. And this performance was better than that. And I was sort of stunned how many times they got it wrong.
We'll talk about a lot of these movies that you saw once they're released in the United States. But at the very least, give me your don't get into too much detail, but give me the three best movies that you saw from 3 to 1. Just quick thumbnail. Who made them? Who's in them? And 2 sentences, what you liked, so we can leave on a happy note.
Number 3 for me was Graduation. It's the new film from Christian Mungu, who won the Cannes Palm for 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days. Romanian.
Christian loves Romanian movies. I live this every year.
Yes. As do most critics.
Yeah, I know. Like, I'm not ripping on you. It's
just
good.
Pointing that out.
It's just a motif.
And this, I think, is one of his best. It is about a father who lives in a not great community that's kind of crime ridden. He is very talented, teen daughter is about ready to graduate and go off to college. And all she needs to do to get this great scholarship is pass her final exams. Right before she takes her exams, she's actually assaulted on the way to school. And what the father decides to do is that because she's so shaken up and isn't in the right mind, kind of headspace to take her tests that she needs to get this scholarship, he's going to kind of pull some strings to make sure she passes anyway. But as he's going to quickly learn, you can't just expect a favor and not have something demanded of you. And the movie is this sort of slow unraveling of his really well-intentioned plan because he loves his daughter so much and just wants her to have a better life.
All right, number two.
Number two, I've never been a huge Jim Jarmusch fan. We've talked about this on the podcast. That said, I absolutely love his new movie, Patterson, which stars Adam Driver as a bus driver in a small town in New Jersey who does poetry on the side. And the movie is just 8 days in his life. It's one of the simplest movies Jim Jarmusch has done, but it connects with his overall sort of existential themes about why are we here? What's the point of all of this? And also there's a great kind of metaphor about art and life. Adam Driver is fantastic. He should have won the Best Actor prize.
All right. And no, that's exciting to me, by the way. I'm pretty amped about that one. And number one.
Number one, one of the most divisive films of the festival, is Andrea Arnold's American Honey. This is her fourth feature film. She had done Red Road and Fish Tank and Wuthering Heights before this.
We talked about this in your Cannes preview podcast.
Yeah, and very briefly.
Shia LaBeouf.
Shia LaBeouf is in this. It stars a newcomer named Sasha Lane, who is absolutely phenomenal in this movie. She is part of a group of sort of young directionless teens who are going across America selling magazine subscriptions. If you have ever gotten a knock on your front door from some young people who want to sell you magazine subscriptions because they're either trying to pay their way through school or raise money for a charity, it always seems slightly fishy. This is a movie about those characters as they tour America. I think this is one of the great American portraits. I think it's one of the great portraits of teen life in America. The fact that it's done by an outsider, Andrea Arnold is from England, I think actually makes it even more sort of pronounced and profound. I think this is a beautiful movie. Shia LaBeouf, this is one of the best things he has ever done. Perhaps that's faint praise, but he is really, really terrific in this movie as well.
All right. So, well, I encourage everyone to go to timgrierson.blogspot.com. You can see his ranking of all 33 movies. I also encourage everyone to go find some of his old Cannes Film Festival rankings so you can see how they match up. Last year, your favorite movie from Cannes was
The Lobster.
The Lobster. That's right. That's right. Okay. And the other time you went, do you remember? Is that too long ago? Do you remember?
Well, I missed 2014, but 2013, it was Blue is the Warmest Color.
Blue is the Warmest Color. All right. Well, those are two good movies that you've talked about so far. So there you go. I'm looking at the end. There you go. So Blue is the Warmest Color. All right, Grierson. That was Cannes. Everybody Hates the Jury. If you liked a George Miller movie, just know now that you were wrong. So, all right, our next movie, this one, the one movie, actually, that we're going to talk about this week that we have both seen, you saw it in Cannes, I reviewed it for The New Republic, is The Nice Guys.
There's a couple of people I trust say you're pretty good at this. I want you to find Amelia.
I would have thought your job ended with breaking my fucking arm.
You're the guy who beat up my dad.
Hey, sucker punched your dad. Big difference.
All right, The Nice Guys is written and directed by Shane Black, the writer of Kiss Big Kiss Bang Bang, director of Iron Man 3. Back in the 90s, one of the old great Lethal Weapon was kind of known, Last Boy Scout, like was known for writing these, like being the non-idiot Joe Esterhaus. Let's go with that for Shane Black. But he's a very literate writer, very fun, likes writing about men and like and particularly male friendship in a lot of ways. And The Nice Guys stars Ryan Gosling, who plays a man named Holland March, who is a private eye in Los Angeles in the 70s. He meets a kind of a brute brawler named Jackson Healy, played by Russell Crowe, and they end up kind of thrown into this old-timey, this kind of 70s, they come across porn stars, everyone's smoking weed all the time, everyone's drunk all the time. It really it hits, one of the things I wrote about in my review, and I want to talk to you about this, Kirsten, it is, you know, Inherent Vice was divisive for a lot of people. You liked it a lot more than I did, but I could still get on the film's vibe. I feel like this is the scrubbed up, cleaned up, accessible version of that movie in a lot of ways. And I say that not in a critical way. I actually found The Nice Guys very enjoyable. It's very fun. I joke that you've heard a lot about how it is a buddy cop movie, the way that they used to make and so on. But to me, like, you know, while part of that's true, it's really, you know, I kind of like that it embraces the buddy cop idea as a genre rather than a cliche. I guess the exact terminology I use in my review. It basically just takes these two guys that have their own kind of personalities. It throws them together and throws them into the story that is kind of confusing, but generally has an interesting through line to it. This is a very, very fun place to hang around for 2 hours. So I very much enjoyed The Nice Guys.
Yeah. And I did too. I, you know, the one thing I would definitely add is how great I guess it's Angourie Rice is. She plays Ryan Gosling's daughter in the movie. The fact that she actually ends up being a crucial element of this movie, I was very happy with. In film school, we actually studied Shane Black's scripts, and you know he's a big Hollywood screenwriter, so you think, well, what could you learn from his stuff? But they're so well written. Just on the page, you sort of see his movies, you see his characters. And they move really, really nicely. And the whole time I was watching The Nice Guys, I was reminded of those film school classes when we studied him. Because, yeah, it is sort of a simple sort of like buddy cop movie on one level. But it's so smartly done. And the way it kind of just keeps looping and turning and curling and then kind of folding back on itself. There's actually like I would argue, is a somewhat serious kind of moral angle to this movie. When Ryan Gosling's daughter asked Russell Crowe, asked kind of both of them, but are you a bad person? And that's kind of an element in the movie. Are these people actually bad people or not? The movie actually has enough weight to give that some consideration. And I think it works really nicely, which leads to the second thing that I really liked. It's used somewhat as a joke, but I really appreciated the fact that in big set pieces, like there's a scene at a party where a shootout occurs, people in the background get shot. They get hit. And on one level, yes, there's something kind of funny about that. But there's also kind of, again, like this idea of, no, in these types of things, random people get shot and get killed. And there's enough of a seriousness to that that I was really, really, I was just impressed by. And also, we haven't mentioned it yet, but Gosling and Crowe are really good.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. In particular, Gosling. They're great together. But Gosling, to me, you know, Gosling kind of has this reputation as being like this methody kind of guy and very serious. And, you know, I think that his character in Drive, I mean, I don't think never mind smiling. I don't think his face really moves in that movie so much. And I don't, not that people don't find him charming or people don't like him, but generally speaking, you know, it's rare that he's thought of as like a serious actor who surprises people sometimes by being a little light. He is a incredibly skilled comedian in this movie. He's incredibly he's likable, which I think is that wasn't surprising. But he's very light on his feet. He's very deft. He kind of has, there are a lot of scenes where he plays, not only plays a ton of physical comedy, but there are scenes that, as sharply written as they are, he has to carry all the comedy in the scene and does it effortlessly. Like, I've always liked Ryan Gosling. This might actually be my favorite performance of Ryan Gosling. It might not be maybe the best performance, but it's the one I just truly enjoyed him. There's still enough weight to that character and him wanting to figure out what kind of dad he is for his daughter and what kind of detective he is and whether he's an alcoholic or not. There's all this, like, these shadings to his character that are very entertaining, but most of all, he is just flat out fun in this movie.
Yeah, I number one, I thought of you while watching the movie.
Of course. The number of people that have seen The Nice Guys and have emailed me and said, hey, another guy that can't smell like your affliction, there's been plenty.
That's why your hearing is so sharp.
Yes, yes, that's why.
So
yes.
it's so attuned,
and people around me are constantly dying because I can't smell the gas that's in the house.
And number two, I like that beat. I actually thought that worked really because it's such a throwaway comment, and then later it actually matters. My reservations about the movie is I do think you kind of alluded to this already, but it is kind of overly complicated in terms of what the actual plot of this movie is. And it's not very, I find it being not very satisfying in terms of why they were doing what they were doing. Though I agree, I just enjoyed hanging out with these characters.
The set piece that finishes the movie is well done and exciting, but kind of the conclusion that we kind of walk away from, I found that a little unsatisfying.
Not serious as the two performances are, I think the overall like point of it, I'm kind of like, oh, was that what the point was? So that's the one thing. This movie is a bit disposable. It's a bit, you watch it and then you kind of forget it. There's not much to it, but it's very fun in the theater as you are watching it.
Yes, and you're right about, I'm going to get an Angoury Rice. It's very weird to me that there are now, I'm praising performances in movies by someone that was born in 2001.
Yes.
It's disturbing.
It had to happen.
So I agree. I think The Nice Guys is really fun. I didn't see, I forgot to check my box office reports. It doesn't sound like it did well.
I mean, to be honest, this is the type of movie that I think if people see it, they will dig it and tell other people. But it is a movie that people aren't going to rush out to see opening weekend. But I think if people are in the mood for it, especially with some of the other things that are coming up in the next couple of weeks, I think this might thin kind of nicely.
Yeah, I joked in the lead of my review that it is the type of movie that if it would have come out in like the 90s, it would have had a series of increasingly unsatisfying sequels that would have come afterward, but we would still all watch them. It is fun. Like it is. It's a shame. That's why I think there's been this kind of run of, when people talk about the movie, how much they like it, there's this run of like nostalgia. They're like, they just don't make them like this anymore. Like making it look like it's, you know, it's Fred McMurray or something. But I do think that there is a notion of, oh, wow, we shouldn't be so blown away by a very smartly written movie with two very entertaining performances at its lead. And yet it still feels like this little jewel tossed in the middle of our summer.
No, I mean, David Poland actually kind of made this point, which is that, you know, people kind of complain about, oh, studios, they're so awful. They just make all these comic book movies and superhero movies and franchises. Well, this is one that they didn't. And if it doesn't do well, then
there will be fewer of them.
You can't come. And he also mentioned, because we both also liked Hail Caesar as another example of this, which I totally agree. Like the problem is that neither of those movies are great. They're just good. Like they're solid, good, entertaining movies. But yeah, if those movies don't find an audience and aren't hits, well, you know, again, if they were better, it'd be easier to kind of make this argument. But yeah, like, well, you kind of can't yell at studios because if this movie doesn't do well, they're going to put Ryan Gosling and they're going to put Russell Crowe and other types of like big franchises instead because you can't make money on these types of movies.
All right, so what'd you give it?
I gave it a very high B.
Yeah, I gave it a B plus. I gave it a, I found it, again, we've joked about this before, it's the perfectly solid 3.5 star out of 4 movie. So go out there and get yourself some better buddy cop movies, America, and go see The Nice Guys. All right, so our last movie on this podcast, finally, at last, some equilibrium has been returned to this podcast because I, for once, have seen a movie that Grierson hasn't seen. The last movie we're going to talk about is Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising.
We're never going to sell our house with a sorority living next door. What are we going to do?
Maybe it's not that bad. Girls are usually quiet. They don't really take hard drugs. And they're much smarter.
Oh, no. They killed a girl.
I'm a pig killer, bitch! Capitol!
Now, Grierson, you have a different theory. Because, you know, when we've done this before, and you have seen a movie and I haven't, because I commit to the purity. I don't want to know what you thought of a movie until I see it, until I've seen the movie. But you do not want to mute yourself for this conversation. Tell me why and tell me how you want to do this.
I'm kind of curious to actually hear, to engage you and ask you a couple questions about the movie, because I have actually read I've read no reviews. I kind of know a general sense of how people feel about it and generally what the thought of what works and what doesn't work.
Are you going to see this? That's the real question. Are you going to go see this?
I may actually go see it later today, actually. So yeah.
Well, shit, man. Then I don't want to ruin it for you.
I can compartmentalize. It's not a problem. It's up to you. If you want me to walk around, I'll be happy to.
Okay, so Neighbors 2 is a sequel to the 2014 movie, I believe. Neighbors, in which Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne move in next door to, as it turns out, their young parents. They move in next door to a frat house. I actually really enjoy the first Neighbors. I actually really liked it. My favorite part of the first Neighbors, and I wrote about this on Deadspin, in my some of my favorite performances of that year, was Rose Byrne. I thought she was fantastic in that movie. She brought something that, frankly, a lot of those Seth Rogen movies have needed. Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg movies, in that not only a strong female character, but a strong female character that did not seem to spring from the minds of Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. She was my favorite part of the movie, and I generally found that movie smart and well done and well thought out. Now, Neighbors 2. Now, as I mentioned in my review, the key thing about I want to give Neighbors 2 credit, because I do think a lot of people are giving it credit. Way too much credit, I might add, for basically having its heart in the right place, in the idea. I've heard Neighbors 2 called as, like, it's sneakily feminist and surprisingly progressive. And I think there is some truth to that. I think that the movie is very the gimmick this time a sorority moves in next door. This time, Chloe Grace Moretz is the leader of this sorority. She gets very frustrated that on the college campus where they are, this is a nationwide fraternity sorority rule, by the way, that men are allowed to host parties at the fraternities, but women are not allowed to host parties at sororities. So she starts up her own sorority. And one of the great jokes of the movie, and one of the stronger things the movie has to say, is the notion that all of these fraternity parties have all of these women basically being, you know, these objectified, they're constantly called hoes in the movie, all of these frat parties. But once you actually have women have their own parties, they're actually really fun, and they're still all getting stoned, and they're all having a good time the way that the guys do. That is a good point. That is something I'm glad this movie brings up. Congratulations, Neighbors 2. I'm proud of you. Thank you. I hope that helps. I hope there's someone out there that gets that message and runs with it and then leaves the theater, because the Neighbors 2 is, it has so much of the Hangover 2 problem in that it is the same movie, but we have tweaked it slightly just to remind you that you're not watching the same movie. It repeats jokes from the first movie. You know, last time the Rose Byrne and Seth Rogen invaded a fraternity party. Now they invade a homecoming float. And like, you know, there's like a ton of stuff like that that the movie hits beat for beat from the first movie, but just twists a little just to remind you that that it's not the same movie. And to me, more worrisome in this is that the performances feel a lot more strained. Zac Efron is playing the same guy again. He does, but Rogen and especially Byrne have nothing to do in this movie. There's a lot of, one of the fun parts of the first movie was their kind of banter back and forth, and they're kind of like, you know, the fact that they're young parents, they're incredibly tired. They don't, and you know, they also don't want to accept yet that they are in fact the old people. This movie, rather than like take that joke to the next level, instead just has them do that again. My argument, Grierson, is I think that some of the praise that you've seen for this movie is because people are surprised that there's actually a positive message, particularly in its treatment of women in this movie. And then therefore they're like, oh, that's a little bit more than I would have thought. And they're ignoring the fact that otherwise this is a really lousy comedy.
Yeah, that was a bit of my worry, I have to say, because in terms of Seth Rogen's career, I thought what was interesting about the first movie and This Is the End is they both seemed like a very natural evolution of the kind of bromance movie that he had been making for quite some time. And this idea of, okay, so what happens when you all start to kind of grow up a little bit and your friends start to fall apart a little bit and kind of go into their own world and you're not as close as you used to be because you're getting older? That was This Is the End. And then in the first Neighbors, this idea of, okay, if you become the parent and you start to settle down, and now there are people who are younger than you who are essentially replacing you, how do you deal with that? And I thought the first Neighbors did that really well. I agree. I thought Rose Byrne was really, really terrific. And I thought Efron was really good too. one of the other things I've sort of read or sort of heard about is that in terms of the Efron character, that there's sort of an evolution of that character that's somewhat interesting and kind of poignant. Is that, do you feel that way or do you not feel that way?
I feel like there's a general kind of sadness to him that's there in the first movie and is there again in this one. But Zac Efron was starting to make an interesting turn in his career, and Dirty Grandpa is just such a disaster that I think it hurts that more than it actually hurts him more than it actually hurts De Niro. This is just a better than that, so there's that going. But I don't really feel like there's a major progression in that character. I feel like it is the same character that it was the last time. He's the only person in the movie that changes. Maybe that is giving people some excitement about it. But I feel like he changes because the plot needs him to, not necessarily because it's something that comes from the heart of that character. But I really do believe. And listen, you know, you and I have talked about this before. How much it is not fun to, when a movie has a positive message that you agree with and feel like it's actually maybe a good thing that people should hear, that the rest of the movie around it is bad. That's never a fun place to be. But that is where I am on Neighbors 2.
Fair enough. When you were describing the repetition of jokes, the two thoughts I had was, number one, is there going to be a De Niro thing again in this one? And then my second thought was, oh, not that airbag or the couch joke or whatever. Because I feel like the first, I may be wrong about this, but I feel like the first Neighbors was the first comedy to really do the, let's have a really impossible CG physical bit of comedy. Like you saw it in the second, those stupid Kevin James mall cop movies. Like the second one of those, like when he gets kicked by the horse, where it's like, it's actually physically impossible to make this joke happen because the actor would die. So we'll just do it in CG. I feel like Neighbors was the first one to do it. I'm assuming it's just as not funny in the second one.
It is. And this is the last thing. It's funny. I wasn't going to mention this, but you brought up CG, so I had to do it. There is a scene in this movie, and when you see it, you will know what it is. Because one of the tenets of the movie is, you know, of course, just like in the first movie, there has to be the scene where the sorority turns on Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne, and they do a series of pranks on them. There's one very stupid prank that's clearly thought up while they were on set, that the payoff from the gag literally is the worst piece of... It's not even CGI. It is bad Photoshop. And the problem is the gag, like the badness of this is meant to be the punchline and meant to be the joke. And at that point, I already didn't think the movie's funny, but at that point it became clear, oh, they just don't give a shit. And so that is my review of Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising. They just don't give a shit.
I'm going to guess your grade.
Okay, yeah, that's fun. This is fun. This is a fun game. Yeah, let's do it. We'll do this again next time we do one of these. Guess the grade.
I'm going to guess you gave it a C-.
That is, Grierson, it's almost like you've known me for 25 years. That is correct. I gave it a C-.
Yes, because anything below a C-, I think we both feel the same. Anything below C- is like, that's a serious transgression. Where this is just, it sounds like, just dumb.
Well, so, that's why, to be honest with you, when we were discussing the Dolan movie, I was actually really curious, is he going to give it a C- or D+?
That's why I couldn't remember. It was somewhere in there. It was somewhere in that range, yes.
All right. So there's a little journey through our brain of our grades that we've been honing for 25 years. So, Grierson, you're back. We're ready to go regular back on weekly podcast again.
Very much looking forward to it. And by the way, don't see Angry Birds, if anybody is wondering.
did you have to see it? Did you have to...
I saw it in advance of Cannes, and no.
Birds are freaking pissed.
but Will, why are they pissed?
I don't know, man.
This movie explains.
I've been wanting to know. I'd play the game and be like, okay, but why?
Really quick thing, and then we'll let our listeners go on with their lives. First line of the press notes for Angry Birds. This is not verbatim, but it's close enough. We always knew they were angry, but in Angry Birds movie, we'll find out why. No human being who's played that game has ever wondered that question. They've never pondered that. The movie answers it anyway, so you're welcome.
All right, so we didn't have a reboot this week, but we're going to fix that for next week. As you know, part of our new initiative, we always tell you the movie that we're going to do our reboot of at the end of every podcast, so you can watch it during that week. This week's movie, given to us by friend of the podcast, Alan Sepinwall, from the great TV writer for HitFix, and he has got a new book coming out that I recommend everyone go buy, The Revolution. I think it's the new version of The Revolution was televised, and I think he's got another movie coming out with Matt Zoller-Seitz. Everyone should read that. Sepinwall is the best. He wants us, if you know Alan Sepinwall's work at all, you know the movie I'm about to say. We're going to be talking about Midnight Run, the 1988 movie directed by Martin Brest, starring Robert De Niro, Charles Grodin, Dennis Farina, Yaphet Kotto, and really Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin. So we're going to be talking about that next week. We encourage you, if you would like to have your movie on the Talked About podcast, please give us a nice review on iTunes and give us the name of the movie, and we will eventually get around to it, including John Wick, guy on Twitter that keeps yelling me to review John Wick all the time. We will get to John Wick, I promise.
He's going to go John Wick on you pretty soon if we don't.
I don't want to try. I didn't kill your dog, man. Leave me alone. all right, Chris. So we'll be back next week talking about Midnight Run. We will also be talking about X-Men Apocalypse, which both of us saw so long ago, it'll be hard to remember at this point. You'll be seeing it again beforehand. And we'll also be talking about Alice Through the Looking Glass, which is a Alice in Wonderland movie not directed by Tim Burton, correct? This is not a Tim Burton one.
That is correct. The director of Muppets and Muppets Most Wanted directing this one, yes.
Even Tim Burton got tired. It happens. All right, so Grierson, we'll be back with episode 19 next week. Welcome back. Welcome back stateside, Grierson.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's very nice to be back.
Of course. Have a great week, everyone. We'll be back next week. Be safe.